Hello and welcome to Historical True Crime, the podcast where we take a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 77. We're setting out on a historical investigation to unravel the bewildering mystery surrounding the Somerton Man, a story that decades after it was first told still confounds investigators and amateur sleuths alike. We'll go back in time to Adelaide and Australia's scenic Somerton Beach in the summer of 1948, with golden dunes extending down the shoreline and the soothing sound of waves lapping against the shore. The picture looks like something from a postcard. However, in the middle of this tranquil setting sits a startling discovery that would set off a mystery that remains unsolved. A passerby will discover a man's lifeless body leaning against a seawall on a fateful December morning, his back against the chilly pavement as though in silent sleep. Wearing a dapper suit, shiny shoes, and a perfectly ironed shirt, he looked every bit the epitome of sophistication. But behind this respectable exterior was a riddle that would defy explanation, as officials would soon find out. Who was this mystery man discovered stretched out on Somerton Beach's sands? What mysteries lingered in the depths of his quiet gaze? And most eerie of all, what terrible fate did he suffer that night? Get ready to enter a world where deceit and truth are expertly intertwined as we explore the complexities of this puzzling case and lift back the layers of time. Even the most seasoned investigators are baffled by the enigma surrounding the Somerton Man case, which includes codes hidden in pockets and covert links spanning continents. Come along as we go through this case in pursuit of answers, assembling bits and pieces of evidence, and figuring out the threads of a mystery that's persisted for years. Every turn of this story takes us closer to discovering the truth about the mysterious Somerton Man. So fasten your seatbelts, because we're about to set out on a voyage into the depths of darkness, one in which secrets of the present can only be revealed by means of the past. In order to fully understand the background of the Somerton Man mystery, we need to take a closer look at Australia's colorful late 1940s tapestry, paying close attention to Adelaide, the charming seaside city where the mysterious event took place. Australia was going through a period of significant social and economic change following World War II. Located on the southern coast, Adelaide grew to become a bustling center of business and culture, drawing immigrants from all over the world drawn to the sun-drenched, lucky country in search of fresh opportunities. Adelaide had begun to develop into a modern metropolis by the late 1940s, with busy streets full of theaters, cafes, and retail stores. The city's famous architecture combined Art Deco flair with Victorian grace and symbolized its confidence for the future and newfound affluence. However, beneath the surface of this thriving city, it was struggling with social unrest and post-war rehabilitation. Its residents still carried the scars of battle in their memory, and the quiet streets were shadowed by the threat of espionage and intrigue. Adelaide's beachside districts, home to the picturesque Somerton Beach, provided a tranquil haven from the bustle of the city. Families would congregate here to take advantage of the sun, sand, and surf, while finding comfort in the soothing sound of the waves. However, the quiet of Somerton Beach was disturbed on a fateful December morning in 1948, when a dead man was found there, serving as a sober reminder of the secrets that lay beneath the surface of this idyllic, but otherwise unremarkable place. Let's start at the very beginning. On Tuesday, November 30th, 1948, at 7 p.m., jeweler John Bain Lyons and his wife took a stroll on Somerton Beach, a coastal community located several miles south of Adelaide. They saw a well-dressed man lying on the sand with his head leaning against a sea wall as they took their walk. He's lying approximately 20 yards away with his feet crossed and his legs spread wide. The man lifted his right arm and let it drop back to the floor as the couple watched. Lyons thought he was trying to light his cigarette while drunk. Another pair saw the same man laying in the same position only 30 minutes later. Looking at him from above, the woman saw that he was dressed strangely for the beach, in a perfectly tailored suit and sharp new shoes were polished to a shine. With his left arm spread out on the sand, he remained still. The pair thought he was just sleeping, but he had insects all over his face. The boyfriend even made a joke, saying, "He must be dead to the world not to notice them." It wasn't until the following morning that it was clear that the man was actually dead. Not just dead to the world. After going for a morning swim, John Lyon saw a group of people gathered near the seawall, where he had seen this drunk man the night before. As he approached, he noticed someone hunched over in a similar manner, with their feet crossed and their head resting on the seawall, but the body was cold now. However, there weren't any signs of violence of any kind, and a partially smoked cigarette appeared to have dropped from the man's mouth and was resting on his collar. According to Dash for SmithsonianMag.com, 3 hours later the body would arrive at Royal Adelaide Hospital. Dr. John Barclay Bennett recorded the death time as occurring no earlier than 2 in the morning, stating that heart failure was the most likely cause of death, but adding that he also suspect poisoning. The man's pockets were arranged on a table, revealing tickets from Adelaide to the beach, gum, matches, 2 combs, and an Army Club cigarette pack that included 7 cigarettes of a different, pricier brand. No ID, no money, and no wallet were present. The man's clothing was completely devoid of name tags. In fact, the maker's labels had even been expertly removed from all but one of his items. A single trouser pocket was tastefully fixed using orange thread. John Burton Cleland, a pathologist, reported that the individual had a British appearance and was in top physical condition, with an estimated age of 40 to 45. The individual in question possessed the following physical attributes: a height of 5 feet and 11 inches, gray eyes, fair to ginger-colored hair, broad shoulders, a narrow waist, hands and nails devoid of signs of manual labor, big and little toes meeting in a wedge shape, akin to those of a dancer or someone wearing boots with pointed toes, and prominent high calf muscles typical of those who regularly wore boots or shoes with high heels or performed ballet. The man's final meal was a pasty, which he consumed 3 or 4 hours before he died, according to the autopsy. However, tests on the body didn't turn up any kind of foreign objects. I'm quite convinced the death could not have been natural. The poison I suggested was a barbiturate or a soluble hypnotic, said pathologist Dr. Dyer in his conclusion. Poisoning did remain a strong possibility, but the pasty was not thought to be the cause. A complete set of fingerprints was collected, distributed, and sent across Australia and the English-speaking world, but nobody was able to recognize them. People were brought into the mortuary from all across Adelaide, in the hopes that they could identify the body. Some were the anguished relatives of people who had gone missing, while others believed they knew the man from pictures that had appeared in the newspapers. But nobody could identify him. The police in South Australia had looked into every lead they had by January 11th. The scope of the investigation was now expanded to look for any personal belongings that could have been left behind. This required looking into the area's hotels, dry cleaners, lost property offices, and train stations. However, the plan worked. On January 12th, a brown suitcase that had been left in the cloakroom of Adelaide's major railway station was discovered by police. It had been left there on November 30th. Nothing about its owner could be recalled by staff, and the case's contents didn't provide much information. Although there was a spool of orange thread in the case that was exactly the same as the one used to fix the dead man's pants. But almost all traces of the owner's identity had been meticulously removed from the items. There were no labels or marks on the case, and one side's label had even been pulled off. All but 3 of the clothing items inside had missing tags. 3 did say Keen or T. Keen. However, it was impossible to find anyone with that name, so police came to the conclusion someone had purposely left them, knowing that the dead man's name was not Keen or Keen with an E, according to an Adelaide newspaper. All that could be deduced from the luggage was that a coat discovered within the case had likely been made in the United States, based on its front gusset and feather stitching. The fact that the coat was imported suggested that the man had either visited America himself or purchased it from a person of a comparable size who did. Police called in another expert, John Cleland, and a professor of pathology at the University of Adelaide, to re-examine the body and his belongings. 4 months after the body was found, in April, Cleland's search turned up one final piece of evidence, the most puzzling of all. The deceased man's pants had a tiny pocket sewed into the waistband, which Cleland found. although it had been overlooked by earlier examiners and called a secret pocket in some cases, it appears to have been designed to accommodate a fob watch. Tightly coiled within it was a small piece of paper that, upon unfolding, revealed two words typeset in a complex printed script. It said Tamam Shud, meaning the end or finished in Persian. These were torn from a book that was later turned into police. They're the last lines of the poem, the Rubaiyat, written by the Iranian polymath Omar Khayyam in the 11th century. When taken at face value, the additional information raised the possibility that the death was a suicide. In reality, the South Australian police never pursued a murder inquiry beyond their first missing person one. However, this discovery didn't help them identify the deceased, and in the interim, the body had started to decay. Plans were made for a burial, but first police had to have the body embalmed and a cast of the head and upper torso created because they knew they were getting rid of one of the few pieces of evidence they had. Following that, the body was buried and covered with concrete in a dry location that was picked in case they needed to exhume it later on. 8 months after the investigation started in July, there were results from the hunt for the correct Rubaiyat. A man brought in a copy of the book and an unusual tale to the Adelaide Detective Office on the 23rd. In December of the previous year, he and his brother-in-law had taken a drive in a car he kept parked a few hundred yards from Somerton Beach, shortly after the body's discovery. A copy of the Rubaiyat was discovered by the brother-in-law on the floor near the back seat. The book had been in their glove box ever since, because the two men had silently decided it must belong to the other person. They only took a closer look after reading about the search for the book in the newspaper. They discovered the last sentences and a portion of the last page had been ripped off. It was then that they went to the police. Interestingly, the book contained several handwritten annotations, including a suspected code and the phone number of a nurse, Jessie Jo Thompson, who lived near the site where the body was discovered. When presented with the Somerton man's death mask, Thompson appeared completely taken aback, to the point of giving the appearance she was about to faint, this according to a detective sergeant. Still, she denied knowing the man, and authorities didn't press her further on the issue. In response to a question concerning the book, she stated that she had provided a copy to a man in 1944 by the name of Alfred Boxall, who the police believed at that point had to be the Somerton man. But Alfred was found alive, and he had an undamaged copy of his book. From there, the trail would go cold. But the book did contain another handwritten annotation that was a suspected code. Again, according to Dash for SmithsonianMag.com, it's hard to decipher a code from only a fragment, but police did try their best. They allowed the message to be released in the media and forwarded it to Naval Intelligence, which employed the best cipher specialists in Australia. This resulted in an amateur code-breaking frenzy, nearly all of which was useless, and a Navy message stating the code seemed to be unbreakable. This was their message. From the manner in which the lines have been represented as being set out in the original, it's evident that the end of each line indicates a break in sense. There is an insufficient number of letters for definite conclusions to be based on analysis, but the indications together with the acceptance of the above breaks in sense indicate, insofar as can be seen, that the letters do not constitute any kind of simple cipher or code. The frequency of the occurrence of letters, whilst inconclusive, corresponds more favorably with the table of frequencies of initial letters of words in English than with any other table. Accordingly, a reasonable explanation would be that the lines are the initial letters of words of a verse of poetry, or such like. Now, we are unavoidably pulled into a maze of guesswork and supposition about the Somerton man's true identity as we learn more about this mystery. There have been numerous theories over the years about his true identity. One widely held theory concerning the Somerton man is that he was a spy caught up in a global conspiracy of intrigue. Supporters of this theory cite his impressive physical fitness, his untraceable origins, and the mysterious code discovered concealed in a pocket of his pants as proof of his covert operations. There's another theory that the Somerton man was a victim of a failed love affair. Some people speculate he met his premature death as he was involved in a forbidden romance, possibly involving a married woman or a foreign national. This notion is supported by the fact that he had no personal belongings or identification on him, which might indicate he was purposefully trying to hide his true identity and potentially the nature of his relationships. But there have actually been some recent developments to this case from Adelaide University's Derek Abbott, who has spent years studying the case and testing hair from the Somerton man's body for DNA. Now, the South Australian police have never confirmed this information, but Professor Abbott got in touch with Stuart Webb, who he believed was the great-grandson of the Somerton man's brother, after discovering a favorable match with Webb family members who had posted their family tree on a genealogy website. Stuart's sister, Christy, consented to do a saliva test, which came back right in the middle of the range for a DNA match. He turned to American forensic genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick, a trailblazer in the use of online family tree data to solve cold crime cases, for assistance in deciphering the mystery surrounding the Somerton man. Professor Abbott stated, "We looked for people who had no date of death. There was one that stood out because he was male. He was roughly the right age, and he was very closely connected to the Keane family, and the Somerton man had the name Keane on his tie. Charles was the one who had fallen off the radar following 1947. In an attempt to confirm or refute Charles' identity as the Somerton man, researchers dug deep into his mother's side of the family tree to see if there were any living relatives who could provide a DNA sample. Now, many of the family members that Professor Abbott was able to locate have been contacted by police, but police have not disclosed any information regarding the status of their own independent DNA inquiry. Police said in a statement that the matter involving the Somerton man was still being aggressively investigated, and said, quote, "We look forward to the outcome of further DNA work to confirm the identification, which will ultimately be determined by the coroner." So even though Professor Abbott and many others believe the Somerton man to be Charles Webb, as of the recording of this podcast, the identity of the Somerton man is still unknown. And beyond the case's impact on popular culture, the Somerton man has had a profound impact, influencing public opinions and igniting a general fascination with historical riddles and mysteries. Online amateur investigators and armchair detectives are still diving deep into this case, sharing theories, examining the available data, and working together to try and find a solution. The Somerton man has remained a figure of interest and mystery over the years. We do have more questions than answers as we come to the end of our episode into the Somerton man. This case has captivated national attention, from the serene beaches of Somerton Beach to the complex networks of clues. Speculation has spanned decades. Beyond simply being an unsolved mystery, the Somerton man's story serves as a testament to the tenacity of human curiosity and our never-ending quest for answers. The mystery and debate surrounding the Somerton man is interwoven with intriguing theories of espionage and potentially forbidden love, and it grows more and more complex with every new finding and every year, enticing us to keep diving just a little bit further. In their search for answers, novice detectives and experienced investigators alike are working together to try and find an answer. And who knows, maybe someday the mystery surrounding the Somerton man will finally be solved. And with that, we've come to the end of another episode of Historical True Crime. Please remember to rate, review, subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to reach out to us, you can always follow us on social media, on Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod, or on Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. You can also reach us by email if you've got any feedback or a suggestion of a case or criminal to cover on an upcoming episode at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. Then we'll see you next week for another dark and notorious case from history. We'll see you then.